Yeah, a lot of times that's going to look like the wife doesn't work. So the wife is reps, the husband works, or vice versa, right? I mean, the wife could work and the husband could be reps too. I'm fine with that.
Welcome to the Real Estate Professional Status Podcast. Join me as I sit down with the tax experts and real estate investors to learn how you can qualify for the real estate professional status and how you can use it to amplify your real estate investments. My name is Usher Fried. Let's get right to it. Welcome to the show, Sarah Ward. Sarah, how are you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing amazing. It's not raining. It's fantastic. Can't be better.
Can't complain.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what is it that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Sarah Ward, and I am a real estate agent and real estate investor. I live in San Diego, and I work with buyers, sellers, and investors just to buy property and sell property in San Diego and all over kind of Southern California. But I really like to stay in my San Diego bubble. And, you know, I work with everyday people like first-time home buyers. I work with people that want to sell their house and get the most money for it. And then I work with people that want to learn how to invest. And I've kind of treated my whole business around the idea of wealth building and how anything you do in real estate is an investment at the end of the day, even buying your primary residence. So I always come to my clients with the strategy behind it and say, like, let's not do all emotion. Let's also look at how purchasing this property could affect your portfolio and your wealth over time.
Got it. So even though you said you help residents buy their first home and investors, but you have that overall strategy of focusing on every purchase as an investment. So you really just help investors overall. And sometimes that investment is their first house that they're buying.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, it kind of goes the other way. And what's made me really passionate about it is I've had some clients come to me that are older and they want me to sell their house. And I've legitimately had clients hand me a spreadsheet and say, if you can sell my house for this number, I can afford to live for 7 more years, because they don't have a retirement. They don't have any assets. All they own is their primary residence. And that breaks my heart every single time. And it's made me really passionate to go out to younger people and say, hey, I know you're buying your primary residence, but let's try to, you know, talk about other assets. Do you need other rental properties? Do you need properties? Do you need stock? Do you need an IRA? Do you need this? Because you can't just leave all your money in your home and expect that to work out for you.
So if someone comes to you and they want to buy their first home, you immediately, not immediately, but you hit them up with these other options and just broaden their horizons of what they could do. Because I figure people buying their first home are just scraping by, just have enough for a down payment. So how do you turn that conversation into investing?
Yeah, 100%, right? So you have to feel it out, because some people are just not having it. You know, other people, you know, want to learn a little bit. I try to sprinkle it in. You know what I mean? First of all, I'm a real estate agent, so I have to think about the long-term value of a customer. My easiest sales are referrals and repeat clients. So I want people to buy or sell with me and then come back again, because that's great for my bottom line. But at the same time, you kind of have to think about what the people want, what their goals are. And I don't want to be overbearing with it, but I do like to talk to people about buying 2 to 4 units, living in one, renting out the others, kind of house hacking, buy a condo, rent out the rooms, those kind of things. I talk to people with their first purchases, really trying to stretch to the best of their ability, especially in San Diego. We have so much appreciation. You know, I know you have people listening to this from all over. We are not a cash flow market. We are an appreciation market here. And so really, the goal for people is to buy in a better neighborhood that's going to go up over time. So another thing I'll do is I'll talk to clients. We have some zip codes here that don't appreciate like others. And I'll bring out all the charts and be like, here's this zip code's appreciation. Here's this zip code's appreciation. Look how flat this one is. And really just try to educate them not only on the type of property they're buying, but also the location they're buying in for the long term. And I just like to give people as much information as I can and let them make the decision or come back to me and ask for more info and guidance.
Okay, really cool. So first time home buyers, you know, obviously are coming to you from a different angle than someone who's investing, but you sort of put everyone through the same funnel of looking through a purchase of a house or a property as an investment, not just some place to live. And that's why you might give them ideas that they probably would never hear of if they wouldn't have you as their broker.
Exactly. 100%. I find the whole real estate investing thing and then the tax benefit side of it absolutely fascinating. So I do always like to talk to people about their different options. And then San Diego has a lot of tech here as well. We have some big tech hubs. We have campuses. Illumina has a campus. ServiceNow has a campus. Qualcomm's here. So we get a lot of people with RSUs. And so I like to talk to those kind of people about diversification as well. You know, you have a lot of risk when all of your assets and your job are at the same company. And so right now the stock market's down, but as the stock market goes up, I get people saying like, hey, I have all these RSUs vesting, I'm getting over leveraged. And I work with them on saying, okay, let's pull some out of stock, move some into real estate, you know, either move it into like the S&P 500 and spread your risk a lot more, or let's get it into a hard asset and buy you a rental property and stuff like that.
Which reminds me, when the big bank collapsed earlier this year, Silicon Valley and New York Signature Bank, my brother knows someone who worked at New York Signature Bank his whole life, had stock options. Everything was just invested in that, in his company. And now in one day, he lost his entire net worth, everything, all of his life savings, done, finished. No job, no money.
It's so sad. And even with these really well-established tech companies, or, you know, we have biotech here as well, and you think you're all established and something happens and it knocks you out. And, you know, you just need to prepare yourself. And it's hard as an individual to work your full-time job, try to do your life, do your social life, and then also have this look at your financial future. That's why I always like to kind of bring it up with clients and see if they have any needs or want to dive deeper into it or want to talk about it.
How did you get involved in this? How did you start?
Excellent question. So I have 10 years experience now as a real estate agent. I did start out as an agent, and I was very blessed to have good mentors in my life. You know, a lot of people talk about trying to find a mentor, and I've grown up my whole life trying to learn from everybody else's mistakes. I think it's really interesting. And I've always liked to talk to people older than me and just, you know, who are they? What have they done? And what have they experienced? And try to gather all that knowledge so I can kind of live vicariously through them, right? My dad was a business major. He ended up being an attorney, and he kind of raised me in this idea that like, owning your own business is really cool. And how would you sell this? And like, everything's a business. It was really cool to learn from. So I got to San Diego State, just loving business, super excited. I was able to get a job at a test prep center for San Diego State. And the owner there really took me under his wing. He had been a real estate broker for 10, 15 years before I got there. He and I really like working together. So he's the one who kind of got me into the real estate side of it. And when I was like a senior in college, right before I was graduating, he had a client call saying, hey, can you come list my house? To which he called me and said, hey, can you help me with this? Months before I graduated, I'm doing open houses, the house tour side, helping with the flyers, photography, all of that. And I just fell in love with it. I just woke up one day and I was like, this is what I want to do. I never finished my resume. I never applied for a single job out of college, not one. I didn't want to do that. I fell in love with small business and hustle. I've always hustled, and that's what's really fun for me. So the real estate industry just leans right into that. Going back to talking about mentors, the owner of the Test Prep Center mentored me so much, and he's the one who really got me into real estate investing. He told me about how you can do FHA loans with 3.5% down and how you can buy two units and live in one and rent the other. It just all clicked for me. It really made a lot of sense, this idea of live in one, rent out the other, tenants pay half your mortgage. Now, if you listen to podcasts and stuff about real estate investing nationwide, they talk about how your tenants can pay your full mortgage, not in San Diego. But thankfully, I was able to get into a position. My fiance now, we were just dating at the time. He really wanted to buy a place. I really wanted to buy a place. And we just decided to buy something together. I was a licensed real estate agent. So the worst case scenario was we break up and we sell it. Really low stakes. So he had his life savings. I had a little bit of savings. We both had good income. We were able to qualify. And we said, okay, we want to buy a fourplex around $1 million. Couldn't find anything. We ended up buying a duplex. We were both 24 and bought a duplex, lived in one, rent out the other. It was $665, our first purchase. And the tenants were in place in the front house paying $2,000 a month. The mortgage was about $4,000 a month. We were able to live in a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house for about $2,000 a month. But we had to do a full remodel too. We did the 3.5% down, fixed up one of the units, moved in, lived there for a little bit, did a refinance into 20% equity because appreciation market in San Diego, a remodel and like a year and a half, and we had good equity. So we were able to refi, drop our payment down, and we were living there for a couple of years. I think our share was about $1,700 a month for a remodeled 3-bedroom, 2-bath house.
Wow. That is the dream that everyone is trying to do. Pull that off. Sounds, you said it just in like 45 seconds, so it sounded pretty easy. But how easy was that? I mean, you did have the advantage that you had your mentor on top of you. You did have a partner to go in it with you. But how complicated was that first leg, getting that first house?
Let me tell you what the worst part was. The worst part, I was over at my fiance's parents' house, and his mom came up to me and said, "Are you sure you know what you're doing?" And that was the worst moment. I just was like, I think so. But I did. The scary part is California and tenant laws and making sure you're educated on that. And I felt comfortable with it. It's an older couple that was living in the front house. They had lived there for 10 years before we bought it. They're still living there now. They paid their rent. The landlord had good things to say about them. And I just went with it. I think also, I'm by nature a risk taker. I like to go to Vegas. I like to roll the dice. That helped. My fiance is not. So I had to know what I was doing well enough to talk him into it.
And his mother. His mom's probably not such a risk taker.
No, absolutely not. I bring all the risk taking to the relationship for sure.
And no friction there. No friction there. You and your mother-in-law are best friends.
So it's all worked out in the end.
She's the best.
You know, we closed escrow and she was there day one helping us pull down old curtains and getting ready for the remodel and taking out the dirty carpet and all of that. So, no, full support. And I've talked about it before that this whole idea of house hacking is basic math. And I did it on the 2-unit property, but I talk to clients nowadays, especially very young people in college, right out of college, about buying a 2-bedroom, 2-bath condo and just rent the other room to your friend. You don't even have to tell them you own it. Just like, I got this spot. You know what I mean?
And that is a hack. That is a hack.
Right? And it's just one of those things, like, you guys are probably going to rent a 2-bedroom apartment anyways. If you can qualify for the loan on your income, if you can get the 3.5% or 5% down, a lot of times condos, you want to go 5% conventional. If you can get that money together, why not buy something and rent it out?
Right.
Then you own something.
You own something, you're building the equity, and you're living in a house for 50% off.
Exactly. It's 50% off, and every month you're paying yourself.
And you're learning a skill that you'll be able to build on top of at your own pace, as long as people are paying you rent. And then, like what you did, which I'd love to jump into that, how you built on top of your first investment. Right. I'm assuming at this point in time, you were not. I mean, I guess you could have been claiming reps at this point in time because you were a broker and you owned a property.
You know what? I could not qualify for reps at that moment. And it was because I was still working a W-2 job at the test prep center at the time. And I think that I would have been audited for that. While I have claimed reps with a W-2 income, I've done it on a much smaller scale. There was no way I was going to be able to prove to the IRS that I was spending most of my time as a real estate professional. So that first couple of years, I was doing part-time at the test prep center, trying to make ends meet, right, pay my bills. But also because W-2 income is how you get loans. Having that W-2 income allowed me to do this because we had 2 salaries. And then the real estate commissions I was making, that's how we got the down payment and remodel budget together.
Right, right. It happens to be that I hate it that the W-2 income gets you the loan for some reason over, let's say, you owning your own business. Your employees will have an easier time getting a loan off of the salary that you're providing them than you because you don't have a stable job.
Oh, 100%. And it's a huge roadblock for a lot of people. I talk about that a lot too, that you really need W-2 income. And then you can team up with someone with W-2 income as well. So I teamed up with my fiance. He works in tech. He has that W-2 income. And that's been very helpful for us now because we rely heavily on his income to continue to purchase properties. I know there's some workarounds as you get more established, but I've talked to loan officers where if you have a W-2 and a 1099, one spouse in each, if the W-2 spouse can buy the primary residence, 1099 spouse can still be on the title but not the loan. And if you can prove that W-2 spouse made every payment out of their own personal account for a year, then the 1099 spouse can claim they have no primary residence to go against their DTI. So then 1099 spouse can easily qualify on rental properties because they're not being bogged down by the cost of their primary residence. W-2 spouse can take care of the primary residence that's a high payment, while the 1099 spouse is in charge of qualifying for the loans on cheaper investment properties. If, say, you're buying $100,000 single family, a duplex for $150,000 somewhere, that's easier for the 1099 person to qualify for, but by removing their primary residence off their DTI, that allows them to qualify for more off that income.
Okay, wow. So you're both on the title?
And only one on the loan.
Oh, one on the loan. Okay, so Yep. You're both on the title and one on the loan, and that allows the 1099 partner to be able to go ahead and get another loan and not be held down by the primary residence. But it's a primary residence that first purchased, right? It's not an investment property.
That's a great question. I'm not a lender. I just know a lot about it, right? So lenders can point everyone in the right direction. But we bought our first one as a primary residence, 3.5% down FHA. If you're going to use a low down payment loan, you must live in the property. And that's a really important point for people because I get a lot of people asking me if they can buy investment properties with low down payments. So you have to live in the property and the lender has a right to do an occupancy check for a year after the close of escrow. So we bought our first one FHA, 3.5% down. We lived in it, I think, for about 2 years. Then we repeated because you can do more than one FHA loan. You just can't have more than one at a time. So remember, we bought the duplex and then refied it into 20% conventional. Well, then we were eligible for another FHA. So we bought the second duplex, lived in one, rented out the other, did another refi. That was all great. Now we have our first duplex is gaining the equity, gaining in equity, gaining in equity. We decided, okay, we're becoming eligible for a cash out refi on that one. Rates were still low. This was in like 2019, 2020. We went ahead and did the cash out refi and pulled $100,000 out. Now, I'm sure you guys know that when you pull out debt, you don't pay taxes on it. So we were able to pull out that $100,000 tax free, and that allowed us to buy more property. So after getting to 4 units here in San Diego, we decided we wanted to try the out of state to try to build up cash flow. San Diego's all appreciation. All of my properties have doubled in value, which is fantastic. But we want some more monthly cash flow, right? So we decided to start by buying a property in Florida. We bought a duplex there. We had to do 25% down, right? Because it's a non-owner occupied loan as opposed to like owner occupied, right? So 25% down. I think our first purchase was like $230 out there for 2 units. Got tenants placed, got property managers in place. We actually bought it sight unseen. I've still not seen it in person to this day. We bought it in 2020, but we were able to do that. And then we branched from there. And then we started buying property in Indiana. So we now own... We have 4 units in San Diego, 2 units in Florida, and 6 units in Indiana as of right now.
Wow. Okay. You know, you started with your own residence, you built out, you bought another residence, moved in there, and then you went out of town and started buying there for the cash flow while the properties in San Diego have appreciation, right? So San Diego has high appreciation, but you wanted to have a higher cash flow. So you went out of town and now you have a nice looking portfolio that you'll keep on building on, and you have pretty stable renters, it sounds like. Did you have struggle getting renters for any of the out of town properties?
2023 has been a struggle on our Indiana properties. We've had four of the units turn over. So we are dealing with some vacancy issues right now. It's all part of the price to pay. When we started out looking at the cash flow side of it, you're always thinking like, this could help to pay our bills at some point. But the reality is, it's not going to help pay your bills for a few years, right? Because things happen, you're on small margins to start. For the first like 5-10 years, you're really just trying to like hold on to the property, right? And not have to put a bunch of cash in. We look at our cash on cash return is what we look at for our out-of-state properties, what our dollars are doing for us compared to what our dollars can do for us in California. That helps ease it. But really, those properties are going to be long-term. I'm now telling people it's really guaranteeing our retirement. In 30 years, the tenants will have paid off those properties and we'll own them free and clear, or we can put more debt on, I guess, if we want to, and then have some really good cash flow coming from these for out-of-state rentals. So we're moving back to picking up appreciation now. And it's just a matter of aligning our portfolio. We've seen a lot. We think if interest rates come down, prices here are going to go way up. So we want to get some more properties here. We're trying to hold our San Diego stuff, kind of hold everything and see what happens with the market right now. But, you know, going back to what you're saying, there's a couple things. First of all, like, it's not about timing the market as much as time in the market. When I bought my properties, like, people could have argued that it wasn't the best time. You know, things are expensive and they are so cheap now, it's out of control, right? It was just a matter of being comfortable with the payment, stretching a little bit, you know, while you're still able to maintain it, because the payments get just much more manageable over time. So for people that are on the fence, and I mean, we've been dealing with this for 3 years, right? As soon as 2020 hit, people were like, I'm not going to buy now. Like, it's a bad time to buy. Oh, do they wish they would have bought in 2020? And then now I have people like, oh, we're just waiting for interest rates to go down. You and everybody else, what's going to happen to prices? Everybody's going to jump in and then prices are going to go up. It's a fine line. This is what I tell clients too. You have to be comfortable with the payment. You have to be comfortable with the living situation. You have to be able to live there for 2 years, because then you get your 2-year tax-free gain. You never want to be so uncomfortable you can't make it to the 2-year mark. Because if you're going to sell a house, you want to make sure any profits are tax-free. And then from there, could you stay for 5 years if the market gets bad?
To hold out.
Yeah.
It's basically with any investment, you're never going to win with timing the market in anything. Usually the people that try to time it, even if they hit it once, they end up losing everything later. Everyone's talking about Bitcoin, how it went up to billions of dollars. People became billionaires overnight, right? But they also became broke overnight, those same people, because they kept on piling it in, thinking that, oh, it's going to be amazing, and they'll pull out the last second. Anyone who got involved in GameStop probably did not make money.
Yep.
You know, in the long run, unless you pulled out
right
away. You have
to sell to make the money, right? And so all my talk about appreciation, how my properties have doubled in value, well, that's all theoretical unless I sell them. And that's why we picked up some cash flow properties too, because we got our money working for us in different ways, because nobody knows what's going to happen anywhere. And your appreciation is all theoretical until you sell or pull out debt.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. What you have already. So it's not so theoretical, your investments.
Exactly.
When did you learn about the status of being a real estate professional along your investment journey? How did you learn about it and how were you able to qualify for it?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I love podcasts because I drive in my car all day and I just get bored. So I've listened to thousands of hours of podcasts. I am self-taught on pretty much everything aside from what my mentors have taught me. And that's my advice to all people that want to do what I do, want to do what real estate investors do. Listen to stories, listen to what other people have done and learn from them. I listen to real estate investing podcasts, real estate sales podcasts, And I like to listen to real estate tax podcasts because I find it super interesting. I started with just the tax benefits of buying a property, right? You get to write off some stuff, then started into, okay, now my rental properties, I have this depreciation, so I'm not paying any taxes on my rental income. I started learning all about how that works. And I got to a point where I go, I can't do my own taxes anymore. They got too complicated and I know I'm leaving money on the table. And so that's when I brought in my CPA, right? And said, okay, please like look at what I'm doing. And that's where I really started to learn about this real estate professional status and how I can qualify. Since 2020, right, like obviously COVID changed a lot. And for me, the test prep center that I worked at for many years on a W-2 income was heavily affected by COVID. And so by force, my W-2 income fell off. The way I can qualify with some W-2 income, mostly 1099 income, is because I can tell you which days I work for the W-2 income. You know, in a typical year, I'll have a W-2 of $15,000, $20,000, like not much money here, but I can say, okay, here's the calendar, here's the 20 days I worked, and that's where I made the money. So I can map it out if I need to. On the real estate professional status side, so number one, I'm a full-time real estate agent. The IRS can Google me and they will see I am a full-time real estate agent. I help 10, 20, 30 transactions a year. This is what I do full-time. And then, so this is what I know, and you can correct me on anything if I'm wrong, but I know to be real estate professional, there's two tests. So the first one is you have to have however many hours, I think 500, I don't know, in real estate. Is that right?
So 750.
750 hours. I definitely hit that. There is no question in my mind that I hit that. The second one, I believe, is you have to materially participate in your rental properties.
Right. So I'll just go through it because this is where it gets confusing. So it's 750 hours in real estate, and that's one of 11 different activities. And then there's 50%, like what you referenced earlier with your W-2 job, 50% or more of your time spent in a real estate activity. So that is number two, to become a real estate professional. And then the 500 hours is material participating. It turns this specific rental into a non-passive activity.
So the second one, the materially participation in my rentals, I believe it's 500 hours or you spend more time than anyone else.
The seven tests, but you do the 500 hours and you probably do all of them.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't track my time. I just do more than anybody else. So our San Diego properties, I am the property manager.
Uh-huh.
My out-of-state properties do have a property management, but my understanding is you can do the grouping election. And if you materially, I can't say these words. This is why I can't be the accountant. So if you materially participate in one of the rentals, then you can group them all and say they all count together. So that's what I know.
Right. The verbiage that's in all of these rules is tremendously complicated just to say it. And I practice in front of a mirror the whole night for like about an hour. Not the whole night, about an hour a night I practice. You're saying materially participating. There are other words also.
Materially
participating is a hard one. But the 750 hours is not a problem because one of the 11 activities, I think, is selling houses. So that you just take off.
Yeah, selling houses qualifies.
Right.
Yep.
And then you don't have a W-2 job anymore, really. And even your W-2 job, what it was, it sounds like you spent more time in real estate than the W-2.
Yep. 100%. And I think I could have gone with reps earlier than I did. And I think it was just a matter of kind of educating myself on the benefits of it and why I should be doing it. And that's something that I have really learned about is just the benefits of qualifying for reps and what it takes to do it. And obviously, I'm in California, so the 2022 tax deadline just got pushed again. So I haven't finalized my taxes yet. I'm waiting for my CPA to give me the final numbers. And that'll be the final how well reps has worked for me, which is cool. So I don't have like the, this is how it's changed my life, because some of my properties are really new where I haven't had a full year of writing off losses against active income.
Mm, so is this the first year that you're a reps?
No, this is not the first year I'm a reps, but in 2021, two of my properties I had only had for a month.
Okay.
Yeah. So then in 2022, they were rented out for a full year now. And so that's where I'll really see the income, the losses, the depreciation, and all of that, and see how it adds up for
right.
me.
So in 2021, even though you only owned it for a month, with bonus depreciation, you would have been able to take a large chunk of it even in 2021.
Yeah, and we didn't bonus depreciate it. We're looking at bonus depreciating for 2022 because we had some capital gains that we're trying to offset as well. And I don't know how far deep into you want to go with it, but interestingly, we divide things out. So I have more ownership as the reps, since we're not married. So my fiance doesn't qualify for reps because we're not married, but we have to do a math equation on it because of state and local taxes. So we both get our SALT versus him taking part of my reps.
Okay. But once, this is why it's important you guys get married quick. You know, another reason to just push the wedding date up further. I mean, closer.
Well, according to my accountant, we're going to lose money when we get married, but we'll just have to wait and see. I know. And it's because of the SALT taxes and then also the cap on how much interest you can write off on your mortgage. So if we do buy a primary residence and get married, then we'll be able to take less. We will max out. I think it's, you can write off interest up to $750 or $750,000 purchase price type thing. You can't get anything for $750,000 here.
I mean, depending on how much percentage he owns, but let's say if it's 50-50, so now you're going to be able to bonus, whatever. All right, we don't have to, you'll figure out your schedule.
Exactly. So we get schemy and we get, schemy is the wrong word, but we have options and strategic. There's a lot of strategy involved because we just have so much, you know,
right,
we have all these different
things.
Which is cool.
Okay. So very cool. So the first year you qualified for reps was 2021. Is that correct or no? Or earlier? You're not sure.
I'm not sure when I'm 100% not sure.
With a CoreSeg, or is that something that you learned afterwards? Did you find value in doing reps without a CoreSeg?
Yeah. Okay. 100%. So I find value in reps without a cost seg. I have not done a full cost segregation yet. You know, the last couple of properties we've bought have been like 230, 225 to 300 type money. So when you look at the cost seg on that, like these are small apartments, it's two units each. So I'm not going to be able to get, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars right. in a cost seg. If I bought a 12 unit, you know, I'd be doing a cost seg immediately. But with two units, it's not as much money. It's a matter of, you know, do the benefits outweigh the costs?
Right. No, but it's cool to know that even standard depreciation, when you own a few properties, that could have a huge impact. And if you could carry that over to your non-passive income, which sounds like you're doing, even though you don't really have non-passive income, that's the truth, because your W-2 is gone, right?
Yeah, but my 1099 is active, okay. right? Because I'm an active real estate salesperson. So I do have heavy 1099
right.
income.
Very, very heavy.
And that's what I'm trying to offset the taxes on. So I have like my normal write-offs of my business, and then I have my depreciation, my losses on my rental property, trying to offset all of that as well. And then when you qualify for a loan, they add back in the depreciation, which is kind of nice. So that helps out on qualifying for loans as well.
So you mentioned earlier that you show people properties and try to get their toes wet a little bit into the real estate investing. I'm sure people want to claim reps right off the bat because they maybe heard something about it on a podcast. How do those conversations go?
I get two things all the time. So the first one is people think they can do low down payment loans on investment properties, and that is mortgage fraud. I do not recommend it. And then the second one is full-time W-2 employees try to tell me they can qualify for reps. And I go, do you have a full-time W-2? They say, yes. I go, I don't think the IRS is going to let you claim your full-time job is actually real estate if you have a full-time W-2. So I try to like get them to step back from that pretty
right.
quickly.
So now these people, they don't know anything about real estate professionals that they just know that it's something.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the bottom line on tax code, right? Just like so many things in this world, you read it, it sounds okay. You don't understand half the words and you think you know what they're talking about. And people are like, oh, I materially participate. And they don't know that there's tests for material participation. They just are like, I do all the work. That should count for something, right? But they don't understand that you have to qualify not just on the work for your rentals, but also on your full-time work and what you do as a career. Right. People try to say that their occupation is real estate and think the IRS cares. Like, come on.
Occupation real estate, like a broker?
Yeah, you know where you put like what your occupation is on your tax return?
So they'll just write real estate.
They just write real estate and think that's what's going to qualify them for reps.
Uh-huh.
Is that their occupation is real estate.
Okay, so do they still want to go forward with investing?
Yeah, so we talk about what the benefits are outside of reps, right? So what I talk about is number one, with depreciation, you won't pay taxes on the rental income. So if your tenants are paying you $2,000 a month, whatever, $5,000 a month, whatever it is, like it's going to take a while for your depreciation to start to wear down to where you're going to pay taxes on that. And at a certain point you do. And that's another whole thing we talk about with 1031 exchanges and how a lot of times people hold these properties for so long and never sell. And I try to tell them, well, don't you want to reset your depreciation table? Let's move you into a new property so you can start over, you know, and then not be paying taxes on that rental income. So that's a whole nother side. And then we talk about the Airbnb loophole, right? We're in San Diego. We have investment properties here, or tourist properties here. It's a good opportunity. I tell my people, you must prepare yourself to turn this into a long-term rental if laws change against Airbnb and short-term rentals. We have restrictions going in. There's a lot of laws. All of our cities change constantly. One of our cities here in Encinitas has said for years, no short-term rentals, nothing under 31 days. And they've recently changed it. Well, now you need a permit. If you're less than 31 days, you can't do less than 3 days. And so there's a lot of rules everywhere you go, and they're constantly changing. So as an agent working with investors, I say, look at how you'd get out of this property if you can no longer Airbnb it. Always have a plan B. But the Airbnb loophole is a great strategy. I also just really like the idea of having your single family house and having an ADU on your property that you can long-term rent or short-term rent, although you're not supposed to short-term rent ADUs, but like nobody listens to that. So there's all these different options to try to get you the best tax benefits you can. And then I also work with people that are high earners at a young age. And so just the fundamentals of if you own instead of rent, you get write-offs from the interest on your mortgage. And that's a super important thing as well that people don't really think about, because we do have people that are like, I'm 24, 25, like I make really good money. I'm just going to live in like a fancy luxury apartment. It's going to be great. And they're paying as much as a mortgage. And I'm like, let's get you owning it so you can get the write-offs and you're paying yourself and building equity.
Right. When reps doesn't apply to them, there's still tremendous value to just investing in real estate. Now, do you ever have clients that come to you and are in a situation to possibly qualify for reps? What does that look like?
Yeah, a lot of times that's going to look like the wife doesn't work. So the wife is reps, the husband works, or vice versa, right? I mean, the wife could work and the husband could be reps too. I'm fine with that, you know, either way. But yeah, usually it's one spouse is claiming reps for the other. But I like to joke, you know, if you do the Airbnb, then you don't have to marry a real estate agent. So that's a good option as well. But for people like that, I feel like tracking your time is much more valuable than someone like me who has ample proof that my full-time job is real estate. I think that if you are going to have, and I mean, I'm not an accountant, so I have no authority saying this, but I would say if, you know, if you are someone that works, you know, a little part-time job and you want to qualify for reps for your spouse, I would be tracking my hours for sure to prove that.
Right. Because as you mentioned, the W-2 is a red flag. If you are claiming reps, if you're doing it, you want to document your hours and make sure that you actually are a rep so that you could be able to prove it if you get audited.
Exactly. Whereas for someone like me, I'm going to prove it by being like, here's all my sales and all my clients and all my text messages and all my emails. This is like my assistant and my full-time job.
Right. It's what you do the whole day.
Exactly.
Right. And does having reps change the strategy on what the investment is going to be?
You know, I just always ask people, are you looking for appreciation or are you looking for cash flow? And don't say both. Because you can't say both, you know what I mean? And that's the conversation we start with. In terms of strategy, reps versus not reps, I don't think you need to change your strategy. I think it's more about balancing your portfolio, whether you qualify or not, and making sure that the properties you're buying are helping you reach that goal, whatever it is.
Being a reps, being not a reps, it's not going to change the strategy. If you do have the real estate professional status, you could take larger losses against regular income and therefore have more money. But it's not going to change a strategy. Even if you won't qualify for reps this year, it doesn't mean that you should wait until you qualify. If anything, you get involved, like what you did. You get involved, and then you find yourself all of a sudden in a situation where you could qualify for reps and you have a nice portfolio.
I have a whole thing that I talk about how your first purchase is the most important one, because it's another thing lenders look at. They won't let you go backwards. So if you're living in a 2,000 square foot house right now and you want to buy a fourplex that's all one bedroom, one bath, owner occupied, that loan will not go through. They will not believe that you're actually going to buy it and live in it. That you can do it not owner occupied, but if you're claiming you're going to live in one of the units and do a low down payment, they will not let that loan through. So you have to be really strategic with your first purchase as well and think about it. So for someone that's like, well, I'm not going to qualify for reps. Do I even buy something? Is it worth it? Buying something while you're young, you can live in a small place. You can live wherever for a couple of years, get into property and start building up from there. So yeah, you get good tax benefits buying a fancy primary residence because you get a bunch of interest to deduct. But at the same time, starting out with these owner-occupied loans and building up a little portfolio by living in one for a little bit, buying the next one, living in it for a little bit, buying the next one, living in it for a little bit, that's the way to go to build with less cash and then start racking up your tax benefits as well before you go into your big fancy primary.
Got it. So just get involved, jump in, don't time the market, find something that you could afford. Being young, being able to live in a small place and rent out the other is more of a value than low interest rates when you're 40 years old.
Yeah.
Think about the timing for your life versus for the market.
Yep. Yeah, get ahead of it. Get into a place that makes sense, right? You have to be comfortable with the payment, with the place, but get something, own something, get your tax benefits, and then you have options. And you can always sell it, I guess, if you're like, I hate this. I hate these tax benefits.
Yeah. You have to find somebody else that likes tax benefits, though. So I don't know if that's going to be easy to sell. Yeah, I hear. Said your story, how you got involved, how you shedded your W-2 job, moved into full-time real estate. The fact that you're a broker is a huge, huge plus. Either you got to be a broker as your regular job, because most jobs don't translate easily into the real estate world in regards to getting a real estate professional status. You know, even a mortgage broker doesn't have anything, right? And also, to mention this, that you're an independent contractor.
Yes.
So you are considered to owning your own business. And that's important also, that if you are a broker, but you are getting paid on a W-2, you don't own the business. You can't be considered a real estate professional.
Right.
You had that going for you. So are there a lot of brokers in your spot doing the same thing, or a lot of them not getting involved in investment and just sticking to it as a job?
I'm going to say the most honest thing, and I truly mean this. Most real estate agents suck. They're absolute morons. They don't know what they're doing. The bar is way too low, especially in California. It is so easy to be a real estate agent. People out there that are looking for advice, you just have to be careful with who you choose. And I tell people when I'm interviewing, I say you should treat your real estate agent like a wealth management person. Are you going to have someone manage your wealth that's broke? A broke college kid, are you going to have them pick your wealth and how you structure it? Same with real estate. Do you want to work with someone that's never bought or sold a house and doesn't know anything? Or do you want to work with someone like me that believes in real estate, invests in real estate, and has a track record to prove it, and has stood in your shoes as both a buyer and a seller, knowing the emotion, but also all the paperwork and everything that's involved in it. So you have to be really, really careful looking for real estate agents. So to answer your question, most real estate agents don't invest in real estate. Most real estate agents are broke. Most real estate agents don't know what they're actually doing.
The only brokering they're doing is to themselves. They're becoming broke.
Yep, is to being broke themselves. Exactly. So you just want to be careful who you get advice from, right? Double check what people are telling you. And once you find people that you know and trust to give you real estate advice, like, learn as much as you can from them. And it's really good to have a bunch of different people. I have all my different podcasts I listen to. I have my accountant. I have my great lender, that my loan officer. She's incredible. I talk to people, you know, that do flips and do different things. And like, I just try to surround myself with people that are really knowledgeable so I can learn from them.
Right.
You want to learn from the best.
Right. And what are three podcasts that you listen to that you would recommend people listen?
I like the old Bigger Pockets podcasts. I feel, unpopular opinion, I don't love Bigger Pockets' current hosts as much as past hosts. I love Brandon Turner. He's from Bigger Pockets. He now has his own podcast, and it's absolutely fascinating. I'm going to give a random shout out, actually, on the last one. So a real estate agent who's now retired and was coaching for a little bit out of Indiana, his name's Bart Vickery. Never met him. Listen to his podcast. I've listened to a bunch of his stuff. I think for anyone that is a real estate agent, is a great resource. He likes to talk about how you don't get rich selling real estate. You get rich by investing the money you have left over from selling real estate into stock market and into rental properties. Anyone who wants to mentor under me as a real estate agent, I make them listen to every episode he's ever done. He does a great job for helping real estate agents be more successful, but then also just this backbone of you have to put your money to work for you.
Okay, got it. Got it. Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Of course. This
is pretty cool to see a real estate professional status live and well. Very unique in what you do, and the fact that, you know, the opportunities that you lend to the people who might just be looking to buy their first house, they might not even realize, you know, the goal that they struck upon. The world that they're about to enter has having you as your broker. And I guess besides the fact that everybody else sucks, it doesn't sound like anybody else really offers this extra package of education and emphasizing that you should actually look more than just buying your home, but look to already building your wealth. So pretty cool.
Yep, 100%. And so I do consultations with people all day long, especially people looking to buy or sell in San Diego, Southern California, right? Happy to go on Zoom and chat with people and get to know their situation and, yeah, right, give them advice.
So anyone listening to this, how should they reach out?
Best way to reach out is probably on LinkedIn. I do a lot with LinkedIn. So Sarah Ward on LinkedIn. I should come up quick. I have quite a few connections. And then on Instagram, I am at Sarah Does Real Estate. So Sarah with an H, Sarah Does Real Estate.
Sarah. You know, I don't know if you saw Michael McIntyre, but he has a little bit on that.
No, I haven't.
Did you know Michael McIntyre?
I don't think I do. And I love comedy.
Okay. You're going to like it. You're going to have to YouTube Michael McIntyre. I think Sarah is one of the examples that he uses.
Oh, that's so funny. Okay, I'm going to put it up in my thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely, and I recommend everyone check that out.
Oh, I will have to watch it.
Oh, I'm sorry, but you're probably booked now with him because he is hilarious. I went to one of his shows, actually. He's amazing.
Oh, that's awesome.
So thank you so much for coming on. Good luck with filing taxes, and looking forward to keeping in touch.
Thank you so much.